This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
They've taken a national resource that had every probability of lasting and seeing us through a time when we could get to a renewable future of 40 years and cut it down where it'll last 10. And that to me is the horror of what's going on.
When it comes to global oil markets, the one thing that everyone agrees on is that it's complex. The recent plunge in oil prices has many of us searching for explanations. Why has the price of oil dropped from $100 a barrel to $55 a barrel in less than a year? What are the geopolitical and economic implications of this drop? And what impact will these suddenly low prices have on other energy industries, both carbon-based and renewable? This week on Sea Change Radio, the first half of our two-part discussion with renowned energy market analyst Daniel Dicker. Author, former oil trader, and frequent TV commentator, Dicker tries to help us make sense of these slippery oil market fluctuations. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by energy analyst Dan Dicker. Dan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Sure.
Wanted to have you on because of the recent plummet in oil prices. First, why don't you give our listeners a quick thumbnail sketch of what's happened over the last 6 months, and then we'll talk about the impact.
Well, it's been an unexpected drop for just about everyone, not just inside the energy world, but outside of it. We had taken $100 a barrel oil very much for granted. I wrote a book on oil's endless bid, the title telling you everything you need to know about my thesis on oil prices now and into the future. You know, I really expected prices to stabilize at around $100 a barrel and, in fact, go up over the course of time. And I think they will again. I don't think that's in any way ended. But a lot of the pieces of my thesis in that book broke. And they broke all at the same time. A number of almost a perfect storm, if you like, of increased production here in the United States and elsewhere. The Saudis wanting to, in fact, regain market share. OPEC being unwilling to have a production cut, a dollar that's been rampaging upward. Generally, a few more things. The rest of the world economy is trying to chase everybody in terms of devaluations of currency. Chinese growth numbers stagnating. I mean, Europe going into the toilet economically. I mean, it really was all at one time, a huge number of factors. Most of the media points to one, points a very bony finger at one, and says that's the reason. It's either, you know, shale production or a Saudi sort of conspiracy. You know, I think there's more to it than that. But in any event, it's been a heck of a rundown, and it's been entirely unexpected, almost a black swan event, if you ask me.
And I want to get into these bony fingers pointing in a second, but recap what has happened to the prices themselves.
Prices sort of had stabilized at around $100 a barrel and had been, you know, rotating between about $90 a barrel and $110, depending on geopolitical dust-ups, civil war in Libya, various other Arab Spring revolution-type things that sort of put supply in doubt. And this summer saw a number of those geopolitical dust-ups, but instead of seeing prices go up, saw them retreat. And that should have been a telltale sign that something was amiss inside the marketplace. Since then, it's been almost a straight shot down from July to when we were about $103, $104 a barrel to where we are now, which is it actually touched close to $55 a barrel before recovering over the course of the last couple of days, still below $60 a barrel.
So I'd like to pick through some of these theories, conspiracy theories or valid theories, one by one, and then maybe we can look towards the future and what the solution might be for all of us as oil prices continue to go up and down. Over the long arc of history, we've looked at things changing quite a bit in oil. It's not a it's very different from what we've seen in the Dow over the last 20 years, for example. So one of the things that frequent listeners of Sea Change Radio are familiar with is the thesis that the tight oil, shale gas and tar sands, these are only financially good bets in very expensive oil markets where it's, you know, at least $90 a barrel, and it's not a sustainable model under that. And one of the theories is that the Saudis decided, you know what, we're just going to keep production at what it was because we believe that we can bury these new competitors coming from places like North America. Let's unturn that stone first.
Okay. I mean, that's a very simplistic kind of view of what happened inside OPEC and doesn't really go far enough. I think that there are, I think on balance, like I tried to point out, there were a number of reasons why oil fell rather quickly, and the Saudis are one of them. It's not an unimportant piece to the puzzle, but they have, on the positive side to that theory, is they have plenty of geopolitical reasons to want to see oil decline here, none of which have to do with the United States. Mostly has to do with their rivalry between the Iranians and their control over OPEC and swing barrels in the global marketplace, and also to a certain degree about their very uncomfortable relationship now with Israel and Egypt. And in many ways, a lot of foreign policy issues that the Saudis had with the United States during the summer that they felt were inadequately answered. From an economic standpoint, you are right. There's clearly a market share issue here in the United States where we have been producing on balance 4.5 million barrels and have added close to 5 million barrels a day of production from shale oil, which has overswung demand a little bit, not a lot, by about a million and a half barrels a day. But it is enough to, frighten the Saudis and the rest of OPEC into wanting to reassert their ability to be the swing producer inside the global marketplace. So that's the plus side. The negative side is that I think the Saudis were, in fact, very willing to make a production cut going into the OPEC meeting in November. I saw Al Naimi, who is the Saudi minister, travel the globe, in essence, asking members inside the cartel to be partners with the Saudis for a production cut. No one agreed. They made a very special trip to the Russians, which that meeting lasted less than an hour, and the Russians came out almost defiantly saying that they're just pleased as they could be with $65 or $70 oil, which is, I hope, is true because they're getting it. In essence, what the world said to the Saudis was, yes, we need a production cut in order to support prices, but if there's one coming, you're the ones who are going to do it unilaterally. They were clearly unwilling to do that. They're financially much more capable of bearing up under $60 or $70 oil than just about anybody else in the globe. They don't have the kind of government or government programs that require, you know, the kind of money, and they have a tremendous surplus in the bank anyway. They get the oil out of the ground for about $5 to $7 a barrel, as opposed to here in the United States, depending on where you go, where it's 10 to 15 times that. So in all cases, there was sort of a lead up of events to allow, you know, the media and most people, most analysts, to point the finger at the Saudis and saying, well, this price drop is all their fault. I wouldn't place it all there, but they've been a big part of it.
Staying with the Saudis for a minute, there's been analysts for many years who've been saying that the easy oil for the Saudis is dried up, and that they're injecting more and more water into their major oil fields like Ghawar. I think like Matthew Simmons, one of the biggest names in terms of touting this issue in his book, Twilight in the Desert. Do you think that this decision by Saudi Arabia to just keep at current levels despite price disruptions was kind of a message saying, hey, we still got plenty of oil here. We can keep pumping till you're all out of business?
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating question. One of the things that we don't know about some of these sort of less well-developed oil reserves is just how much is there and how easy it comes out of the ground. With Saudi Arabia, we've always made presumptions and assumptions on what they can pump and where they can pump it.
Hasn't that changed quite a bit since the 80s when they decided to have less of a throttle on proven reserves, right? All of a sudden, everybody doubled their proven reserves in the mid-80s when OPEC changed the rules.
Like I say, it's a very interesting question. The jury's still out in my mind. I do believe that the ability of the Saudis to increase production here. By the way, if you're talking about in the 80s, you know, everyone, the common wisdom was that the Saudis had a maximum of 7.5 million barrels a day they could possibly pump under any circumstances. They're now over 10.
Right.
So there's a lot of, you know, known unknowns that become unknown unknowns rather quickly when it comes to OPEC member reserve supply. But in any event, my belief at this point, and again, don't hold me to it, is that at the point where they are producing 10.1 or 10.2 million barrels a day, I do not think there is much more that they could reach for in terms of adding supply to the market at this point. I think they're pretty much at a full throttle, full tilt boogie here. Now, I do not believe that they are running out of oil anytime soon, that there's, you know, the Ghawar field is somehow going dry anytime soon. And again, sometimes when you talk about some of the technological innovations that we have used in the Dakotas and in Texas will reach the Saudis so that they will find all of a sudden they have four times the reserves or capable reserves that they thought they did. I don't know.
This is different than the horizontal drilling techniques that like Saudi Aramco has innovated.
Well, what there is there's injection techniques which haven't been used in Saudi Arabia because they haven't been needed, which have revitalized, for example, what were thought to be dead fields in Texas, conventional fields, not shale fields, not horizontally drilled fields.
I see.
And you know, to the degree that those can be employed or employed further into Saudi Arabia, again, we're all at a loss because they haven't needed to yet. So my guess is that right now they're perfectly happy with the amount of oil that they're able to pump out. They're perfectly capable of dealing with whatever price the market throws at them. They've done it before. Believe me, if the market had as much respect for the Saudis and their ability to set prices as the media sort of believes they do, they'd be a very happy bunch because there's been times, many times in the past, where it's been useless. Look in 2006 when President Bush went to the Saudis and begged the Crown Prince to increase production so that oil wouldn't go over $100 a barrel. And the Crown Prince said, we'll pump whatever you like, but the oil market doesn't listen to us in our supply anymore. And that was true then. So again, it's been a factor. It's been one major factor, but it's not the only factor.
Listen to my story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is, black gold, Texas tea.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy analyst Daniel Dicker. You mentioned Iran a few minutes ago, Dan. Dive into that a little bit more. And also, if you can include the variable of Iraq's oil production into that discussion.
This is really the most difficult place for an oil analyst to go because it's clearly there's a religious struggle between Sunni and Shiite, that underplays this major schism inside of OPEC. Now, the Iranians have been trying to gain control of the cartel for decades, and it has been the Saudis and their majority of production that has held sway inside the cartel for decades. So this has always been one of the things that the Saudis very, very, very much wanted from the United States was to not engage in a negotiation on nuclear aspirations during the summer with the Iranians and remove sanctions because a weakened economy in Iran was very, very helpful for the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia, and that was ignored. So part of the problem for the Saudis, or what they perceive as their problem, is a geopolitical increase of power going on in Iran that plays into clearly how much influence they now have in a newly formed Iraqi government, and the United States walking in and in fact using, or at least asking the Iranians for outright help in the defeat of ISIS. All of this is disturbing and frightening for the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia, and goes to the point of some of the geopolitical kind of reasons why the Saudis might not mind or would mind less than somebody else if oil prices remain cratered for a period of time here, to weaken the ability, or at least the economic ability, of Iran.
Well, just on an apples-to-apples comparison, give our listeners an idea of the production, how Iran and Iraq stack up in terms of production compared to the Saudis.
Sure. So it's not all about present production. Again, I gave you 10 million, give or take, for the Saudis. The Iranians have a capability of about 3.5 million barrels a day right now. And most of the reason that it's only 3.5 million barrels a day is because of sanctions. It really has crippled the oil industry in Iran. That has gotten closer. At least it's hard to know because a lot of black market deals, some sanctions still in place. Oil that's moving by tanker of various nationalities. It's a dirty business, oil. I mean, it's not something that you go to the local governmental agency and find listings of every drop that's produced and where it goes. It's a strange dirty business, and we think that oil in Iran is now reaching 3 million barrels again, getting close to what they were capable of prior to sanctions in Iraq. Obviously, during the war, it fell quite a bit. But again, you were looking at 3 million barrels a day, which they're pumping about right about now, close to that. But in terms of increased production, which very much OPEC was depending on, Iraq is a tremendous resource with the capability of producing upwards of 6 million barrels a day. That will not happen because of the unrest that is going on in Iraq. So there's two questions here. It's not just about production, current production. It's about future production, because we have to remember as we look down the road that despite our better nature, demand for oil in the global marketplace continues to rise in excess of 750,000 barrels a day per year.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy analyst Daniel Dicker. He's a former floor trader at the New York Merck and is a frequent contributor on CNBC, Bloomberg TV, and CNN. So, Dan, let's now turn to the U.S. and Canadian oil and gas production and how this sudden drop in oil prices has affected business up till now. I saw a spot that you did recently saying that a lot of these extractors, are the smaller ones, are in big trouble right away from this price shift.
Yes, and it's simple economics. One thing that's happened over the course of the last 5 years is that in a very, very low rate environment, a Fed-inspired low rate environment, you have a lot of financing of very, very risky endeavors at fairly low rates, one of those being in high yield. So what we have gotten over the course of the last 5 years is an enormous increase in small market, that means not, you know, the big players, but small market E&Ps that are under a market cap of $1 billion. And they were sort of the last in to the shale revolution in North Dakota and in Texas. There's an interesting game of smoke throwing going on in the oil and gas industry, especially among smaller exploration and production companies out in these areas I speak of, where they're talking about not being able to clearly put in the money that they used to put in before in terms of finding new wells, but also incapable at these prices of maintaining production levels. So what we have is we're going to have a lag. If prices stay down here for a certain period of time, if they stay here for 6 months, let's say, which I think they have a good probability of doing, you will start to see some of these companies crack. You'll see them crack as, you know, bonds start to default. You'll see them crack as actual production numbers decrease and the common shares go from already that have gone down 50 or 60% will go literally close to zero. There'll be real bankruptcy risk. And in fact, some of them will go belly up. And that's really the next stage of how this kind of fracking boom bust cycle will work. There's an old bumper sticker that appears in Texas. Mostly I've seen it in Houston, and it comes from, you know, a time in the 80s, and it says, please Lord, give us another oil boom. I promise not to foul it up this time. and it's very clear from the absolute undisciplined way that leases have gone on in the Western United States, flaring of natural gas, and just haphazard drilling practices, that they have in fact fouled it up again. They've overproduced. It has been done with very little oversight from the state, and they've taken a national resource, and this is my real problem with it. They've taken a national resource that had every probability of lasting and seeing us through a time when we could get to a renewable future of 40 years and cut it down where it'll last 10. And that to me is the horror of what's going on.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy analyst Daniel Dicker. From an investor standpoint, when you analyze some of these E&P or exploration and production companies, Dan, how much do you take into account how far along they are in their exploration process and in terms of production levels, and how much do you take into account these leases and the terms of their debt?
Yeah, both are critical. You need to assess the leases that they hold, the wells that they've drilled, the production numbers and the efficiencies of the wells that have already been drilled in the areas that they're working and that they own or they have control over. And then on the back of that, you have to look at their debt position, how much their payments are, how far into the future they're financed, how much they've hedged into the financial markets and how much they haven't hedged into the financial markets. All of this will matter. But some of the metrics, you know, stand out. You know, free cash flow against debt is one of them. And some of the companies, you just look at that, and if, you know, I've seen ratios of 100, 150, 200 times of free cash flow to debt. That math is very, very bad for the viability or long-term viability of any company.
What I don't understand is when these very big projects are underway and already, and there's a big investment underway. Let's take the Alberta tar sands. But we always hear that the tar sands really doesn't make economic sense unless there's pretty high gas prices or oil is in the $100 a barrel range. That's kind of been what the laymen have heard for the last several years. But there's a huge investment already underway in Alberta. And at what point is it a sunk cost?
It's almost immediately a sunk cost. It's like putting up a building or like signing to build a commercial building, some sort of real estate building, and then the bottom drops out of the housing market. You're almost forced to see it through, even though you know at the end it will be a money loser. That's what we call scalability. I mean, that's really where we start talking about scalability. What kinds of production can we curtail a little when market, and how fast can we curtail it when markets are not positive for them? And what are the ones that we're almost, you know, obligated to see through to the end and produce and pray that prices will recover in time to make it a profitable endeavor?
I see.
And that's why we focus so much on shale players, because it's a couple of million dollars to drill a well and a couple of months from start to spud. And that's about as short and as scalable a production timetable as we have. I could tell you about offshore projects in the Gulf of Mexico, another place that is uneconomic at these prices. And, they're billion-dollar operations. They require, 3 to 5 years to finance, and then before the first oil comes out. And when the oil comes out, those wells are viable for, close to 10 years. So these are not things that when you undertake them, there's very little you could do in terms of scalability. You almost have to see it through because the sunk costs are so huge on the front end. You have to continue through with them. And I pray, but it's not really much of a prayer, because in many ways, this is the game. This is the game of chicken that's being played in the oil game right now. It's because everyone knows that at these prices, production has to come offline. But if you're not the guy who comes offline and you're standing at the end of the day, you're still standing, prices will naturally have to rebound, because there'll be, when that production comes offline, a supply shortage.
Right.
There has to be, and everybody knows it. So the question is, how long can you last? Who's going to be the guy to flinch? Who's going to be the one to go broke and not be around for the next boom in oil prices? Because it has to, by definition, it has to come. It's either that or the world will have to find another way to get the lights going.
Energy analyst Dan Dicker, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Michael Omartian, the Allman Brothers Band, and Flatten Scruggs. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.